No one but the pure of heart may find the Golden Grail, which is just what we call the French fries at the bottom of the bag. This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Welcome back to Junk Food Cinema. We'll save every one of you a slice of pie. This is Film School Reject's premier cult and exploitation film podcast that is just bored with irony. I'm your host, Brian Salisbury, Archduke of the Impossible, and I am joined by my friend and my co-pilot, Chewy, is that you? No, it's screenwriter slash novelist C. Robert Cargill.
Hey, everybody.
How's it going, sir?
It's going very well.
Death to Ming?
Death to Ming!
Death to Ming! I want to remind you that Junk Food Cinema is available on iTunes. If you just search Junk Food Cinema in the podcast section, or you can find us on Stitcher. While you're on iTunes, why not give us a 5-star rating and leave a review? That would be super nice of you. You can also find us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. You can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And those little links to the movies that we talk about, if you want to click on those and purchase them from Amazon, that would really benefit us as well. Thank you very much.
Brian.
Yes?
I'm bored. What plaything do you have for us today?
Well, I'm glad you ask. I guess we've been a show long enough that we've arrived at the point of using familiar gimmicks. No, we're not presenting this episode in 3D. We're not locking ourselves in an empty department store overnight until we work out our problems.
That would be pretty cool, though.
That would be. We should do a bottle episode.
Like, we should do a bottle episode, but like do it in an ice cream parlor instead so that we can have all the ice cream.
Let's get this straight. Whenever you and I are involved, every episode is a bottle episode.
That is correct.
What we're doing instead is we are time traveling. X-Men Days of Future Past hits theaters this week and centers on the idea of members of the team who have to travel back in time and change the course of the future. So tonight, we are going to play our own little game of alternate timelines. We've talked about our fascination with, I guess, the what-if scenarios of Hollywood before.
So is this movies of futures past?
This is indeed movies of future past.
Excellent.
That's basically, we've come together to speculate wildly within this little game that we like to play called movies of future past. Anyone who knows me is aware of my captivation by and my unflappable adoration of Flash Gordon. There's just something so magnificently glorious and off at the same time about this Art Deco painting come to life, this weird sort of science fiction drug-addled playground that is Flash Gordon, produced, of course, by the great Dino De Laurentiis. What you may not know is that Dino De Laurentiis had the rights for a very long time. He wasn't the only person who sought them out, however. There's this other guy who, in the mid-70s, was like, you know, I think I'd really like to make a Flash Gordon movie. I've been inspired by movie serials my whole life. I love the Flash Gordon serials. I'd really like to get my chance to bring that to the big screen. But unfortunately, that was not to be. And that guy's name was George Lucas.
Yeah.
George Lucas of Star Wars. And apparently the story goes that he was so frustrated by the fact that he didn't get to make a Flash Gordon movie that he goes off and writes this movie called The Star Wars that actually borrows a lot of elements from two of the original 1930s serials of Flash Gordon.
Yeah, as well as ripping off whole hog sections of John Carter of Mars.
And as well, Kurosawa.
Well yes, so. the most famous, he structurally borrowed from Kurosawa's
Hidden Fortress.
Hidden Fortress. Mm-hmm. I always want to call it the Forbidden Fortress, and it's the Hidden Fortress. The Star Wars was a cobbled together kind of Frankenstein of early genre that created its own thing and became its own universe that now has spun out into, you know, Frankenstein's monster, if you will.
Frankenstein's army. Even.
That, you know, has a huge extended universe that spans, you know, so far six films and six seasons of a cartoon series, plus two seasons of another cartoon series, plus half a dozen other little things scattered around, the Ewok movies, if you count that. The
hey,
the
Caravan movies, of Courage. Plural. Caravan of Courage is an amazing testament to the human spirit.
Yeah.
It's not, but it's fun. It's fun to pretend.
Droids and what have you. And it's just, it's so vast, you have to actually, to find out what kind of Star Wars fan somebody is, you have to actually kind of lay down and go, okay, where do you draw the city limits of the extended universe? You know, do you count, are the Timothy Zahn books the extended universe? Are, you know, are the, you know, any of the books? Are the comic books? Do the Ewok movies actually exist? Do Ewoks, did they learn English? Is that really a thing? You know, you have to actually, like, you know, for some of us, it's three movies and that's it. That's it. It's, you know, there are three movies in the Star Wars universe and everything
there
else.
There are only three movies in the Star Wars universe.
There are only three things that exist in the Star Wars universe and everything else is fan fiction.
The worst thing that ever happened to the Star Wars universe that I know were the Ewoks. Everything else was great because there are only three movies. I don't see what the problem is.
And there it is. And that's where we start getting the hate mail in from everyone.
From people who just love Jar Jar Binks so much they can't believe.
Hey, come on, man. You know, we are being movie hipsters here. We are being Star Wars snobs in stating that we cannot embrace anything but the holy trilogy.
I'm just embracing my dark side right now. That's all. That's fine with me.
That is. But we're not here to talk about Star Wars because,
what?
You know what?
Because in our timeline,
Star Wars doesn't exist.
It doesn't exist.
What if
we have fucked everything in the universe?
We have gone back in time and discovered what if George Lucas, played by a young Peter Dinklage, had actually made Flash Gordon instead.
So he gets the rights in the mid-70s, and the other film of his two-picture deal with Fox, after American Graffiti, is not Star Wars anymore, it's Flash Gordon.
Before we go there, some people have not seen anything Flash Gordon related. There has not been a Flash Gordon movie or cartoon series for a long time. For guys like me, you know, growing up, not only did I have the Flash Gordon movie in 1980, which was a prime part of my childhood, but I had a Flash Gordon cartoon series in the mornings that I watched as well. And Flash Gordon also showed up as a hero in, I forget what the name of the series was, but there was a series in which Flash Gordon was one of the heroes along with Mandrake the Magician and a whole bunch of other comic book or comic book-like heroes from scattered throughout the, you know, the comic multiverse. So let's go in and talk about for a moment who Flash Gordon is in the various iterations, because Flash Gordon didn't start with the movie. Flash Gordon started back as a comic strip that then led into serials. And it was about a young football player blasted into space who ends up, it was very much a John Carter of Mars knockoff. If you don't know your John Carter of Mars, you can go with the big movie from a few years ago, or you can go back and read, you know, the magnificent books by Edgar Rice Burroughs. But this was another one of those almost portal sci-fi, you know, last week we talked about portal fantasy, portal sci-fi stories in which, you know, a person is taken from normal Earth in their time and blasted to this magnificent science fiction space opera kingdom. And, you know, Edgar Rice Burroughs was taken to Mars and Flash Gordon was taken to Mongo.
Well, and it's funny too, because the character is so old that he was actually a polo player at Yale was the original.
Oh, that's right.
In the comic strip,
that's
because
right.
Football was not, I mean, people were playing football, but it wasn't yet a big deal. So he was a polo player at Yale.
At all the versions I've ever dealt with, he's the football player.
They just jump ahead to football.
Or I watch the serials where he's already established. It's already just,
there you go.
It's like, it's fucking Flash Gordon. You don't need it. Because there was a time in this world where we didn't need an origin story. Where we didn't need to see how the person got his powers. It was just like, it's fucking Flash Gordon. Deal with it.
And then
it's fucking Superman. It's fucking Spider-Man. It's fucking Batman. You know how he happened.
And then three years, we didn't need to see again how he got his powers.
Yeah.
Crazy how that works. So yeah, he starts out as a comic strip. And then he makes the leap to the movie serials in the 1930s. Man, I miss the days where we had movie serials where you could go to the movies and not only did you see the feature, but you got it like an installment of... You know, it could be a character like Flash Gordon. It could be something like Undersea Kingdom. It could be Commander Cody and the Radar Men from the Moon.
Yep.
Like, you had all of these just really, like... Captain America. Batman had one.
Captain Marvel.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, it seems a little honky-tonk now when you go back and look at him. But you know what? Like, this was the early days of superhero films before it was even really considered to make superheroes into that kind of marketable commodity. Like, this was a really great way to, I mean, you got to remember that when these serials are being made, you still have a lot of parents groups that are saying that this comic book craze is leading our children down the path of damnation.
Yeah.
Like, this is an evil thing. I mean,
this is back pre-code days.
Yes, very much pre-code days.
Pre-Haze Code. Yeah, it's interesting. You know, the early days of Ain't It Cool, a bunch of us would get together and, you know, several of the guys, Harry and Quint in particular, would buy up these serials, and we would get together and watch the serials and watch them concurrently and project it. As they were originally shown, and they're a lot of fun. They're a lot of goofy fun. They were, they were intended to be part of a, you know, this is back before the days of television in every home, and, you know, kids on Saturday morning, you know, they had the day off. They needed something to do, and they would go to the Nickel Cinema, and they would watch stuff, and they would have a whole cavalcade of stuff, and they would be, you know, an episode of a serial, and it would, be cartoons, and it would be whatever the movie was that week.
Right.
And, you know, and the thing about the serials were part of that insidious marketing of, hey, you're going to have to come back next week too, because you got to find out how Captain America gets out of that car that just went over a cliff.
It was pre-TV cliffhanger stuff. Yeah. Yeah. Literally, when he goes over a cliff, like, it's a
literal
cliffhanger.
That's where the phrase cliffhanger comes from. If you've ever, if you're unfamiliar with it, it's from, you know, quite literally the days when cars would go off the cliff, and that would be the end of the chapter or the end of the episode, and you'd have to find out how they made it out of the car. So this is what Flash Gordon started as. And in the 70s, you know, you've got these two guys, you've got Spielberg and you've got Lucas, who are so in love with the childhood nostalgia that they grew up with in the 50s, which was also, you know, nostalgia tends to go in 20 to 25 year arcs. And, you know, people start getting to their, you know, their 30s, and they start pining for their childhood, and they start, they have disposable income, and they start putting that towards whatever it was they loved as a kid that they couldn't get enough of. And so you see these things repeat. And so in the era of the 70s, there was this throwback to the 50s. And so all of these guys were talking about their childhood in the 50s. Well, their childhood in the 50s was also heavily influenced by the 30s. You know, because everyone in the 50s was, you know, thinking back to their childhood in the late 20s and early 30s. And so these, you know, all of these serials played very much into who they were. And this was them revisiting their childhood. So let's go into this alternate universe where we get a Flash Gordon.
So in this universe, there is no need for George Lucas to write Star Wars, because he is given the chance to make a Flash Gordon movie.
I would also posit for a second that there would also be no need to make Raiders of the Lost Ark.
See, this I was getting there, because that is also heavily, heavily influenced by movie serials. That is the rough and tumble adventurer story that
it was Alan Quartermain.
Yeah, it was Alan Quartermain. So I mean, yeah, there's also not a reason later on for him to make Raiders of the Lost Ark. So he gets Flash Gordon. And luckily for him, a lot of the ideas that made their way into Star Wars are directly cribbed from the first two Flash Gordon serials, Flash Gordon and Flash Gordon Conquers the Universe, one of which being that the basic plot of those serials is that – or of the first serial is that you have our heroes are infiltrating the bad guys' outer space fortress, a la the Death Star, while disguised in the uniforms of the villain's army. So it's very much the Han Solo and Luke – donning the stormtrooper uniforms and going into the Death Star. So that's a big part of it. There's also the fact that, you know, the Emperor's got his own kind of deadly hostile planet, again, like the Death Star. There is a sexy brunette space princess whom the hero defends in the serial. There's also a big, strong, hairy, animal-like ally, which, you know, in Chewbacca, and then, of course, Prince Thune of the Lion Men. And then there's even... Like, the Flash Gordon serial had its own Rancor, for God's sake. Like, there was this weird, like, underground monster in a sort of arena setup. So, I mean, all of these things are elements of the Flash Gordon serials that then made their way into Star Wars.
Which, of course, that was lifted whole hog from John Carter of Mars.
Well, there you go. So you have all of these things swirling around in Lucas's head that instead of going into the script for Star Wars, would make their way into his script for Flash Gordon. Now, obviously, we're dealing with a complete, like, Dino De Laurentiis, as creative as he was, and as much of a force in Hollywood as he was, he looked at Flash Gordon as a, basically just a way to make money.
That's how Dino De Laurentiis looks at everything.
Right, so it's pretty obvious that the passion that George Lucas has for this character is not shared by Dino De Laurentiis. So we're dealing with a completely different type of Flash Gordon movie, something that, you know, I would venture to guess would have also necessitated Lucas to build his own special effects company. He may not have been working. I mean, no, for all intents and purposes, we're talking about him working with the same budget as he would have been working on for Star Wars, because in this timeline, like I said, this is the second film of his two-picture deal after American Graffiti. So he's going to be working with the same budget he worked with for Star Wars to make Flash Gordon.
So it'd be $10 million.
It'd be about $10 million.
Do you think he'd have Hawkman?
I would imagine he would, and I would imagine they'd have those little square, like, optical insert borders around them like the TIE fighters do in the very early prints of Star Wars, and that, to me, just sounds amazingly charming, and I would love to see that play out. But, of course, we have to talk about the casting here, because, I mean, your first thought is, okay, if George Lucas is behind Flash Gordon, obviously Harrison Ford is going to play Flash Gordon. However, if you remember, the actor who almost got the role of Han Solo before Harrison Ford was Nick Nolte.
God damn it, Chewbacca.
And Nick Nolte, at this point in the 70s, I could totally 100% see playing a jock turned reluctant hero. Like, literally, a jock who's like, God, I gotta do what now? Screw all this shit. Really? That's my Flash Gordon.
God damn, Hawkman, always getting in my way. Oh, hell. God damn it. I'm totally stealing this bit, by the way, from Patton Oswalt, who does it brilliantly. So let me give credit before I get called out on that. Yeah, no, it's a brilliant, wonderful bit by Patton Oswalt about Nick Nolte almost being Han Solo. But Nick Nolte almost being Flash Gordon requires that, you know, God damn Ming and fucking Mongo and God damn it.
Oh, you're doing this just because you're bored off. Oh, shit.
Oh, hell. Yeah, no,
that's a movie I would see 100 times.
I don't know if I want to see it.
100 times.
Nick Nolte's just wrong for there's nothing that Nick Nolte does. I mean, Nick Nolte as Han Solo, I see. The problem is everything about Flash Gordon, if you're going for someone of that caliber, you know, you're almost hoping that he gets like Robert Redford, who was still really young at the time. I mean, cause that's the type of, cause Flash Gordon was always the, you know, the chiseled features, amazing looking, all American, you know, Aryan, poster child, who, you know, didn't have any rough edges to him. You know, he was just all American, and that's kind of what went wrong, and also so right in Flash Gordon, which you and I both passionately love, like ardently passionately love. Is that, you know, they're kind of having they zig when you know, it was Mike Hodges that directed that, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, Hodges zigs when Lucas and Spielberg zag, and they go and they don't make Raiders of the Lost Ark to be goofy. They make it serious and just include all of the elements from those serials in the best way and make them funny and make them enjoyable. And Hodges just kind of makes everything camp. And by making everything camp, made a movie that didn't connect with audiences in the way that it connected with children. Whereas Raiders of the Lost Ark is considered one of the, you know, the greatest movies ever made. And they're both addressing the very same era. They're just dealing with it differently. And Spielberg and Lucas are treating it with this nostalgia that I think would really permeate Lucas's Flash Gordon. I think Lucas's Flash Gordon would definitely be a much more serious take on what was going on. I also think he might include, because he was very inspired on Star Wars by the World War II footage, and World War II played heavily in him. And I wouldn't doubt that with all the various spaceship fights that, you know, you find in a Flash Gordon comic, that would have played a much heavier role as well.
Yeah. I mean, the spaceship fights that exist in the current version of the Flash Gordon film are really just conveyor belt sequences. I mean, it's a slow-moving ship, you know, going at a base, and like, and a lot of the fighting is done by people on the ship, but there's no dogfighting. Like, the closest we have to dogfighting are the Hawkmen diving.
Hawkmen dive. Actually, the closest thing is flying blind on a rocket cycle.
Yes, yes.
You know, him zipping around on the rocket cycle is about as close to a dogfight as we get.
Which isn't terribly dissimilar from those little transport things out in the desert in Return of the Jedi. I'm just going to point that out.
No, not at all. No, in fact, Return of the Jedi seems to, you know, all of that stuff, everything about Jabba the Hutt doesn't scream crime lord. It screams character from fucking Flash Gordon. It screams it screams demented prince on a moon of Mongo. True. I mean, it really does.
Yeah, definitely. And you mentioned the Hawkmen before, and not only do I think that they would still be in there, but I think they would have katanas instead of the, I think they were carrying maces in the 1980 version, just kind of those big clubs. I'm kind of seeing that as a place where Lucas might let a little bit of his samurai influence come out, because he's not going to fuck with the look of Ming. He's gonna keep Ming with the weird, like, Fu Manchu facial hair and the bald head. So he's not going to try and, like he did with Star Wars, make his villain into a samurai. Because that's the whole reason Darth Vader's helmet looks like that is because it's a fucking samurai's helmet. So he's got to find some other place to kind of infuse that influence, that samurai influence. And I feel
Clitus.
Like, oh, yeah. Yeah, totally.
I guarantee you that's where he would go with Clitus being that samurai. He would be the Darth Vader character.
Yeah.
He would be the samurai-inspired character.
Which would make sense because he's the number two, which Darth Vader technically is. And the Emperor Ming, Emperor Palpatine, is actually
this is all coming
show.
Together see for you folks. See, all of a sudden, several of you are just going, holy fuck, I've been worshiping the wrong franchise for so long.
Yeah.
But no, at the same time, through Star Wars, we got to see him do Flash Gordon, right? And ultimately, what Lucas ended up doing with that frustration is what a lot of writers talk about, which is, you know, you get a lot of, and I get this question every once in a while, almost every writer of genre gets it, is what do you think of fan fiction? And a lot of writers are against fan fiction. And the reason a lot of writers are against fan fiction is every successful writer was very inspired by other work, you know, was driven to write by other work. And that other work then led them to rip off stuff that they would then go, well, I can't be caught ripping this off, so I have to disguise it. And then disguising it and creating something totally new with it. And then through that process of doing that, learning how to create something new from base inspiration. And that's where you end up with so many of the great genre things. You know, Batman was just a knockoff of Superman. You know, they
went to Bob Kane and said, Superman's doing really well, create us another character.
And he literally traced over Superman time and again until he got something that looked different. And so, you know, so much great inspiration comes out of lifting like that. And so this is what we have here. We have that perfect example. Here we have a really creative, inventive genius in his prime, really frustrated by the fact that he can't get the rights to go and adapt and essentially do his fan fiction version of Flash Gordon with the rights to do it. So it's not actually fan fiction, but he has the rights to go do it. Without those rights, instead he goes, fuck it, I'm just going to rip it off, rip off all my favorite stuff, disguise it, and create one of the greatest science fiction movies ever fucking made.
Yeah. And part of me also wonders, you know, George Lucas is a guy who is very hands-on in the fact that he writes everything that he directs. But there's a part of me that wonders if his...
He doesn't write everything he directs.
He wrote... Oh, you're right. He doesn't write everything he directs. But in the early days, like, he wrote American Graffiti.
Yes.
He wrote Star Wars. And then even things he doesn't direct. You know, he wrote Raiders of the Lost Ark, Temple of Doom. He wrote that franchise. But part of me wonders if his long-established friendship in film school at USC with John Milius may have opened the door, considering the thematic content of Flash Gordon, may have opened the doors for a fucking John Milius penned, George Lucas directed version of Flash Gordon. And it just tightens my pants to consider that.
Well, that
concept
sounds really cool, but would Milius have done it? Milius didn't do anything of the camp variety. Like everything Milius
well,
did.
But that's the thing is we've already established that this is not a camp version of Flash Gordon.
No. But it still wouldn't be. It wouldn't be Conan. You know, it's because Flash Gordon and Conan are two, you know, diametrically opposed kind of moods and feels. And if you look at all the stuff that Milius did, you know, even Milius's lighter fare is stuff like Red Dawn. You know, it's still kind of dark with characters dying left and right and not exactly the type of thing that you would.
Well, let's see if I can think of another script that Milius wrote about a hero venturing into the unknown and try and take out a tyrannical villain. Oh, Apocalypse Now, fuck's sake.
Yeah, no, that was a really positive movie.
No, that's what upper. It's super upper, yeah. You need to take some uppers before you watch that movie. I don't know, like, I get the Milius connection to Conan. I know that's what a lot of people remember him for, but you got to also remember he was the guy who ghost wrote Dirty Harry.
The guy has
an amazing range of things that he could do.
I'm aware of this, but Milius was a guy you went to when you needed to write the manliest of manly fucking movies. Nobody wrote manlier dialogue than Milius. Milius was, you know, when Spielberg ran into a problem on Jaws, he brought in Milius, and Milius wrote the fucking greatest speech in the history of fucking cinema, being the Indianapolis speech.
And I would ask you, what is more manly? What is more male fantastical than literally the premier jock being plucked into this other realm to be an actual hero, going from the realm of being a sports hero, which is, you know, to us in this dimension, a paradigm of manliness, to being an actual dyed-in-the-wool hero in another realm?
If this would happen, it would change fundamentally how we viewed Flash Gordon forever.
Yes.
Like, it would really be bringing him into a new age. And I think that movie, if John Milius wrote and George Lucas directed a Flash Gordon, that Flash Gordon would probably be our Raiders of the Lost Ark. It would probably be that movie that it's like, holy fuck, how have you not watched? You know, there's an alternate universe right now where you and I don't ever talk about Flash Gordon because on Junk Food Cinema, because in that universe, Flash Gordon is so fucking amazing. Everybody's seen it and every nerd on the fucking planet talks about Flash Gordon.
Plus it won 8 Oscars. It's crazy how that works. Flash Gordon won 8 Oscars.
No, that Flash Gordon got snubbed for the Oscar by Annie Hall. Let's be honest here. That Flash Gordon did not win Oscars, and to this day, we don't let the Academy fucking forget it.
Yeah.
And it's in that universe where we can't talk about all the various Flash Gordon movies that then stopped getting made. Yeah, all of a sudden this universe is seeming really weird and not so different.
I'm just wondering what the Jar Jar Binks, like, in the Flash Gordon universe would look like. Just that character that it's like, oh man, you remember back in the days when he was working with Milius and these Flash Gordon movies were so much better right before we got to episode 12? Which literally makes so much more sense when you think about the fact that When the future installments of Star Wars come out, they're not called Part 5, Part 6. They're called Episode 5, Episode... Because, again, he's basing all this shit on movie serials.
Yeah. Yeah, no,
that's literally the way that they're structured. Not to mention the fact that in the early Flash Gordon serials, the text crawls up the screen at the beginning. Just gonna throw that out.
Which, by the way, didn't exist until the re-release of Star Wars.
That's true, but, again, just something else that he looked at Flash Gordon and went, oh, yeah, that's really cool. Let me take that. And, you know, we're talking about what that Milius and George Lucas movie would be and how much it would kind of reshape everything we know about. Like, that's the kind of landmark thing that I would kind of expect him to do in the place of Star Wars. That energy, that creative fire is still there. We point that at a different property. That property becomes Star Wars. That property becomes the landmark movie that starts a cultural phenomena and completely turns the tide of genre films from that point forward. Not to mention the fact that the first major blockbuster in America in 1975 was Jaws, followed closely in 77 by Star Wars. Those were the two movies that invented the damn term.
Yeah.
Flash Gordon could have been that second tier, could have been that second pillar that gives us the term blockbuster, and again, reshapes not only genre cinema, but the way movies are marketed and released in the first place.
Yeah.
Flash Gordon.
Yeah, could have been. But it also could have been a flop.
It could have been a total flop.
It could have been, you know,
it could have been Willow.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is the reason why Star Wars really kind of hit was no one had seen anything like it before. We had seen Flash Gordon before, and would Flash Gordon have held up to the geeks of its time? I mean, this is, keep in mind that, you know, we did not invent geek fandom in the ugly way that it exists now. The internet just makes it louder and more in your face. If you go back and read old Star Logs, you read those old magazines back in the day where people wrote in angry letters about how they screwed up things in Star Trek the Motion Picture and in Wrath of Khan, you know, the angry letters to Starlog. Oh my God, there are angry letters to Starlog about Wrath of Khan and how terrible it is because they can't even get their basic Star Trek right because for fuck's sake, Walter Koenig wasn't even on the show when Spaceseed happened. So there's no way Chekhov could have ever known about Khan. So
that's in the bag. Oh no!
Botany Bay.
I couldn't have read a book about this.
Yeah, no. So I mean, these nerds existed. One of my favorite stories is just how angry all the Superman nerds were at Donner Superman. You know, they were really upset at all the changes to the canon and the changes to Superman that is now the accepted story.
Yeah.
You know, we look at Superman as being the best representation of Superman. The geeks at the time hated it. So would the geeks at the time have accepted George Lucas's John Milius penned, written, you know, take on Flash Gordon in the way that they embraced Star Wars, which had no previous fandom?
It's an interesting question in that, ironically, we had seen everything in Star Wars before too, but it was so subtly woven into the fabric of the narrative that we didn't know. It's like,
we had never seen special effects like that. Like that was
true. But what I'm referring to is like all of the things that we just mentioned before that he cribbed from other movies and kind of piecemeal together very much in the way Tarantino does it. But like Tarantino, he found a way to weave it in to such an extent that it doesn't seem like overt homage and instead entirely supports his vision and allows him to create a unique voice, so it's not just a steady stream of references over and over again. So on that level, I think that question is valid as to whether or not people would have accepted Flash Gordon in the same way, because Flash Gordon would have been overt callback to something that by the time the 70s rolled around would have been a property that, you know, kids' grandparents had been into.
Yeah.
So it's a valid question.
Yeah. And had people had seen repeats on as a child on television.
And the biggest fans of Star Wars, the main contingent of the hardcore fans that really drove forward the phenomena of that franchise are the people that saw it when they were kids.
Yeah.
Are the people who in the 70s, like, I mean, the directors now who tell stories like when they were a kid and their parents took them to see it and they stood in line, they sat in that dark theater, and these really great, almost ethereal stories about seeing Star Wars for the first time. So if you take those same kids and you put them in a situation where they're now watching movies with their grandparents that their grandparents find more accessible than they do, maybe we don't have that phenomenon.
Yeah.
It's entirely possible. And I think it brings up the other thing we mentioned about – I think the answer to that question determines the answer to the next question, which is what happens to the Indiana Jones franchise? Because if Flash Gordon's a flop, it could completely sour George Lucas on serials. You know,
I did it. It didn't work. The audiences don't like it.
Exactly.
And trying anything else with it just isn't going to work. So you know, this whole idea of redoing Alan Quartermain, we should just, you know, torpedo that and move on with my plans for a movie about magical dwarfs.
Which means, at that point, there's no Star Wars and there's no Indiana Jones. The fuck happens to Harrison Ford? He's got Blade Runner at that point. He's got a Ridley Scott movie.
He doesn't get Blade Runner at that point.
Well, okay, but look, let's assume that he does. Let's assume that he does get Blade Runner. Blade Runner, most people forget the fact that Blade Runner, when it came out, was not warmly embraced by audiences. It took years for that movie to actually get any kind of groundswell of love and of affinity. Like, that movie was not, like, immediately embraced the way something like Star Wars
But
was.
He only got that because of the success of his other films. He doesn't get Blade Runner if he's not a star of Star Wars and Indiana Jones.
Interesting.
There, you know, who is he? He's a guy who appears on screen. He's a guy who is in American Graffiti and who appears on screen for a scene of the aforementioned Apocalypse Now. You know, he's a character actor who maybe finds his own, but never becomes the action star because the movies that made him the action star never came along.
And my other question is this. So we're talking about George Lucas's Flash Gordon. What happens to that soundtrack?
Oh, what happens is, first of all, you don't get Queen ever. You get it's clear who does the score for
some 50s
Flash Gordon.
Some 50s rock and roll band, because that's the thing George Lucas at this point in his life is most obsessed with.
No.
Is the kitschy vinyl music of the 50s. Well, I mean, that's the whole reason American Graffiti exists.
Well, but that's why American Graffiti exists. But when he went to make his Star Wars movie, he had he had all of this great classical music in mind and gave it to this young musician, composer, to go ahead and tackle someone who had just worked with and took two notes and created a cultural icon out of two notes.
So you think John Williams?
John Williams. Absolutely.
John Williams is still.
I think John.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense. Yeah, I'd forgotten about the Jaws connection because Lucas would still have been friends with Spielberg. Spielberg uses. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Right,
he definitely goes with Williams.
I think you get most of the score of Star Wars in Flash Gordon, because John Williams wrote that based upon the stuff that inspired Lucas and that Lucas had in his head. Mm-hmm. And that music, I think, would have been the same for Flash Gordon. I think what we get is we get a slightly different version of, I think Ming the Merciless comes out to da, 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 da.
Yeah.
I think that's Ming the Merciless music at that point. You know, I think we get something very similar to what we already had. But we never get that Queen soundtrack.
The Cantina Band anthem is playing at Ming's palace during the fucking wedding. Yeah, absolutely. Oh, okay, so to recap, in this timeline, George Lucas directing Flash Gordon, therefore never has to write Star Wars as his way of dealing with the fact that he didn't get Flash Gordon.
Right.
Star Wars doesn't exist. It's, again, in our very speculative timeline, is written by John Milius. They are creating the most incredible, dark and manly, but also phenomenal version of Flash Gordon that has ever been constructed. And Harrison Ford remains largely a nobody for years to come.
Unless Harrison Ford does get cast as that manly Flash Gordon.
Oh, yeah. I should have mentioned Nick Nolte is apparently Flash Gordon. It's
or up for it. But I'd like to exist in the universe where instead, we get a slightly frosted haired Harrison Ford playing Flash Gordon. And I think in Milius's Flash Gordon, you have to go with Harrison Ford. Definitely. I think it comes down. He has Nick Nolte and he really likes Nick Nolte, but Nick Nolte's just a little too rough around the edges. And he needs somebody a little more crisp and all American, which is exactly why he cast Harrison Ford in American Graffiti.
And then, of course, there's a question of who would play Ming. Now, in terms of Imperial bad guys that ended up, appearing in Star Wars, one wonders if maybe Peter Cushing becomes Ming the Merciless. And, again, causing a bit of a nerd boner in the pantsel region of this guy to think about, once again, Lucas directing, Milius writing, possibly Harrison Ford starring as Flash Gordon, and Peter Cushing as Ming the Merciless. Yeah. Yeah, that movie's coming together nicely in the old noggin.
When we talked last time, you had mentioned somebody else for possibly playing.
Yeah, I thought about Donald Pleasance, because Donald Pleasance shows up as this sort of bizarre character when Lucas turns THX 1138 into a feature film. But I like Peter Cushing. I like – not only do I like Peter Cushing – but I like I can see the concept of Lucas looking at Peter Cushing and going, very imperious and very, classy and yet very cold and foreboding villain, because that's exactly the character he plays in Star Wars as Tarkin. So yeah, I'm comfortable with the idea of Peter Cushing playing Ming the Merciless, even if his tiny stature would not necessarily support a 75-pound costume, as, Max von Sydow was unfortunately tasked to wear in Flash Gordon.
So, who do you think plays Hans Zarkov? Because we don't get Topaz.
Topol.
Topol, that's right. Topol.
I was like, Topaz is not a good Hitchcock film.
Not a good, yeah. Topol. Are you thinking what I'm thinking?
I don't know if I am. The only thing I'm thinking of is fucking Wolfman Jack from American Graffiti.
No. Think a little. Think of another Juan.
Another Juan. John.
Oh, for fuck's sake! Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Oh, yes. Interesting. For God's sake, strap yourselves in. Yeah.
Wait. All of a sudden, we cast a beetle in Flash Gordon?
That's how he talks. You must learn the ways of the Force if you're to accompany me to Alderaan.
Your Obi-Wan Kenobi is a little...
It's spot fucking on. I will not hear any differently.
He's a little beetle-ish.
He was a little beetle-ish. He was a little fucking Liverpudlian in Star Wars. I can't help what the guy sounds like. Come here, my friend. I'm going to tell you about playing the Hollywood Bowl. The point is, yes, no, I'm with you. Alec Guinness as Hans Zarkov is, I could see it. I could totally see it.
Because the thing is that's a Hans Zarkov you could actually trust. Well, no, because that's the thing about Topol. You know, they play Topol as, and that's why Topol works. He's a Looney Tune. He's a cartoon character. And oddly enough, he has this whole rant about the Beatles, you know, later on in the film. But once you're supposed to trust him, you still don't trust him because he's still out of his fucking mind. Whereas I think Alec Guinness is the guy who can really actually convince Flash Gordon to get in that rocket and go to Mongo and then ultimately, helps Flash, and Flash can depend on this guy.
Yeah, no, I can see it. I like it. In our last bit of casting here, in the character of Dale, I mean, does he still go after Carrie Fisher?
I don't think so, because if this happens, this would probably be happening 2 years earlier than Star Wars.
Oh, absolutely.
So it would probably be something coming out in 75, 76, and Carrie Fisher was really, really young at the time. I think she may have just been a hair too young.
So... 1975, 76, I don't know, one of the big marquee named females who is approximately the right age to play reporter Dale.
I think we either end up with an unknown like we did with Princess Leia, or we end up with an oddball choice, because now this is where you get in, you know, to studio involvement. See, with Star Wars, he didn't have much studio involvement because they were like, look, we don't get it, but we'll fund it. It's fine. You know, we'll do it.
Well, and that's because Fox was coming off the heels of this project where, because Easy Rider was such a huge success, they looked at Easy Rider and they're like, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to make 5 movies for less than $1 million. We're going to make 5 movies. We're going to give the directors complete autonomy and final cut. And because they are, you know, being made for less than $1 million, you know, who cares? American Graffiti was one of those movies.
Yeah.
American Graffiti, I mean, that project and that whole thing of giving the directors autonomy and knowing that it was going to be – it's actually a very Jason Blum-like model.
Yeah.
Which is, we're not going to spend a lot. So even if they flop, we're not going to lose a lot of money, and we're going to let relative unknowns have complete control over the movie without any involvement from us. It's actually a really cool era for Fox.
Yeah.
And it pulled them out of – a huge string of slumps. It paid off tremendously well for them. So I'm not saying Star Wars was made for less than $1 million.
No.
But American Graffiti, the whole reason that movie exists, and then by proxy, the reason that Lucas goes on to do Star Wars, is because of this mentality of Fox at the time.
Yeah. And the question is do we end up with one of those hot starlets from the 70s? Like, you know, someone like Diane Keaton before she did Annie Hall, or... Well, I mean, do we end up with someone like Jane Fonda in the role?
That's actually really interesting. At that time, yeah, I mean, she would have been the exact right amount of clout, stardom, and sexiness to play Dale. I would throw out Jacqueline Bisset, actually. As somebody,
Jacqueline Bisset is a possibility.
As somebody who, again, at the time was on the rise, somebody who is very sexy and could have easily played opposite of Harrison Ford. And exactly the type of, like... But there's something about Jacqueline Bisset that's like, she's got kind of a hard edge to her. Like, she's really pretty. She's gorgeous. But she also looks like a woman who could, like, hold her own in a fight, which I see as being sort of a more of a muse for Milius than Lucas, really, because he's looking at her and thinking, you know, I'm going to write Dale as if she's Red Sonja. and, you know, just kind of give her a warrior's edge as well, which Lucas is going to completely buy into because he's on his samurai kick. This all is gelling so well that I just wish that we could jump in the Wayback Machine and make this shit happen. I mean, I love Star Wars as much as the next guy, but I want to see what this movie looks like.
Yeah. So let's just oddball dream casting.
Okay.
What one oddball character from the universe, from the Flash Gordon universe, would you want to see cast by an era-appropriate actor in this movie?
By an era-appropriate actor?
Yes.
Okay.
Like, well, for example, I'll throw out mine.
Okay, go for
it. I would love to see Prince Voltan,
okay,
Lord of the Hawkmen, played by Harvey Keitel.
Amazing.
I mean, that's because, you know, the Harvey Keitel of that era, you know, this is, you know, Mother Jugs and Speed Harvey Keitel. This is Taxi Driver Harvey Keitel. Young, still very good looking guy, got a lot of swagger, very, he's got that kind of brash brutishness that could work. A guy that you could see on screen that you don't want to trust, but you would eventually trust if he's on your side.
Mm-hmm.
And I really feel like he would do, you know, a great job in that role.
Is it too much to dream that 1975 era Charles Bronson plays Prince Baron, who was played by Timothy Dalton in the 1980 version?
That would be an interesting choice.
Not only that, but, you know, the character that you just mentioned, Voltan, I would really want to see Warren Oates play that part. I mean, just, yeah, like, I get what you're saying.
What part don't you want to see Warren Oates play at some point?
But Voltan is like this, like, hard drinking, like, he's seen a lot of miles, just dragged through, you know, yards and yards of bad road. Like, yeah, I want to see that Voltan.
Now, that said, I want to see that Voltan. That said, I also I cannot disparage what is the greatest performance of Flash Gordon,
Brian Blessed. Yeah. Which is funny because
wants to live forever? Flying on a rocket cycle?
Impetuous boy! Dave! You know, which is funny because for years, even as I got into adulthood, it took me years to remember that Voltan was not played by John Rhys-Davies. For years, I confused those two. And what's funny about that is John Rhys-Davies makes a name for himself working in Lucas's other franchise, yep, in Indiana Jones, which in this timeline doesn't exist. So who knows? Maybe John Rhys-Davies crosses paths with Lucas earlier in this timeline, and he ends up playing Voltan, and nobody fucking notices the difference.
Nobody throws a Hawkman. Which is actually kind of true.
Because they fly. They'll just fly.
We don't need to explain the joke.
They don't need to be. But we're going to, because that's always funnier.
It's Welcome to Junk Food Cinema.
Where we do that. You know, in future installments of episodes like this, we'll probably talk about some of the really high-profile what ifs and the almosts, and, you know, and there's a bunch of, even within the superhero genre,
there's a bunch in the superhero genre. Yeah. Hell, Aronofsky has two what ifs.
Yes. And one of the Aronofsky movies I desperately want to talk about, because I only just recently got my hands on the Aronofsky,
Batman Year One
script. Yeah. And Jesus, well, I should rephrase, on the Frank Miller script for the Aronofsky, was to be the Aronofsky directed Year One. And holy shit, if I don't want to see that movie. But that's obviously a discussion for another day.
That is another episode of Movies of Futures Past. There's only one junk food pairing for Flash Gordon.
Man. What's that?
Corn dogs. The rocket ship phallicness of a corn dog, the corny outside, the juicy, hot, meaty inside. Tell me that doesn't scream 70s Flash Gordon to you.
I'm going
to
go a level deeper. It is an American staple wrapped in another American staple, much like a sports hero becoming a space hero.
Yeah, in what space opera. Yeah.
What is more American than a jock becoming an astronaut who's a hero in both dimensions?
Who brings democracy to another planet.
Yes. Yes, he is the
America! Fuck yeah! Flash Gordon coming to bring you democracy! Yeah! Yeah, it would be pretty...
Coming again to fly blind on a rocket cycle! Oh, man. This has been fun. I enjoy these ventures into this parallel universe where...
I kind of want to go visit that universe for a while. You know, you and I have talked about that. You know, some people are like, oh, if I could slide from dimension to dimension, I'd love to see all the various things that I'm doing. And I'm like, I don't give a shit what the alternate me is doing.
No,
I want to go to a movie theater and watch the fucking movies that should have happened in this world but didn't.
Yeah.
I want to see the alterniverse versions, both good and bad.
Totally.
I want to see some really terribly cast stuff that almost happened here.
Yeah, I mean, because we're talking about a lot of, like, best-case scenarios, but there's a lot of Twilight Zone episodes to come out of these discussions, too, just, like, sitting in that theater and just going, no!
Yeah, what
there if... was time now!
Yeah, what...
There was time!
What if what happened is John Milius did write the script for Flash Gordon, and it was directed by Lucas, and it was a total pile of shit and killed both careers, and we never got shit out of either of them again. And not only do we not get, you know, Raiders of the Lost Ark or Star Wars, we also don't get Conan, for fuck's sake.
Yeah.
We don't get Red Dawn, you know, which, you know, you and I both have a fondness for.
Yeah, there's no more jingoistic movie on the face of the planet
except
than Red Dawn.
Except for John Milius's Flash Gordon.
As we've established today. And the big winner in this timeline is not Lucas, it's not Milius, it's not 20th Century Fox, it's William goddamn Friedkin. Because Star Wars is never released and never fucks up the release of Sorcerer. And that movie goes on to be a huge commercial success. Congratulations, William Friedkin. You made out like a bandit in this universe. Well, guys, that's our show. Thank you so much for joining us. I want to remind you again, we are on iTunes as well as Stitcher. And if you go to iTunes, please do give us a 5-star rating and leave a review. You can find the show on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. And you can find Mr. Cargo. Where can they find you on this interweb universe?
You can find me at facebook.com/massaworm or at twitter.com/massaworm. Or you can find, I wrote up a piece last week that you can find on Chuck Wendig's Terrible Mind. Minds.com, Terrible Mind, MINDS. I cannot speak today.
Professional writer. See Robert Carter.
TerribleMinds.com, and you can find that listed on the 14th, so I've got something written out.
And your book, Queen of the Dark Things, is out now.
My book, Queen of the Dark Things, came out last week, both in the United States and in the UK. So wherever English language books are sold in the world, you can find Queen of the Dark
Things. If you live in a place where people talk like this, you can still get the book.
Like a beetle.
Like a beetle. Apparently like a beetle. Well, if anyone's interested, you can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury. You can also find me on Facebook, facebook.com/BryanSalisburyCritic. Until next time, onward, brave junkies. Let this be known forever as Flash Gordon's Day.